This is an ABC podcast.
On RN, this is David Rutledge saying hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. Today marks 1 year since the mosque shootings in Christchurch, New Zealand, where 51 people were murdered and 49 injured by a right-wing extremist. And while the Christchurch attacks were notably shocking and cruel, they weren't an isolated event. All around the world, far-right terrorism is on the rise, according to the latest Global Terrorism Index from the Institute for Economics and Peace. The total number of incidents in the West has increased by 320% over the past 5 years. So what does all this have to do with a program like this one? Well, the Western philosophical canon doesn't exactly have clean hands when it comes to malignant right-wing ideology. Martin Heidegger was an anti-Semite and an unrepentant member of the Nazi Party. Friedrich Nietzsche espoused ideas that would later make him not just the Nazis' philosopher-in-chief, but also the poster boy for 21st century alt-right extremism. Nietzsche and Heidegger have their principled liberal defenders, and a lot of interpretive energy has been expended over the years, some of it on this very program, in arguing that if you read these philosophers correctly, they're not really as dangerous or as problematic as they seem. But that doesn't mean the whole thing is simply a non-issue. And today we're going to be looking at exactly why those right-wing associations with Nietzsche and Heidegger refused to go away, and how these philosophers should be taught at a time when right-wing extremism seems to be emerging once again from the shadows of history. Late last year, Deakin University in Melbourne hosted a conference on philosophy and the far right. The keynote speaker was Ron Beiner, Professor of Political Science at the University of Toronto and the author of Dangerous Minds, Nietzsche, Heidegger and the Return of the Far Right.
It would be nice to think that fields of academic study such as philosophy and political theory are innocent and that one could teach them without the fear of breeding monstrosities. That comforting thought is looking less reliable by the day, which is what prompted me to write a book whose title is Dangerous Minds. Here's the book. Literally, the first book review came from someone who is himself a dangerous mind. Greg Johnson, who runs a white nationalist website called Countercurrents, which is where he published the review. Subscribers to the New York Times may remember him from one of the three shocking videos accompanying the Jesse Singal report entitled Undercover with the Alt-Right. Johnson in the video argued that Jews like me should be required to move to their own ethnostate, allowing the United States to be what it by rights should be, a white ethnostate. Greg Johnson's review was 5,000 words long. It took him until precisely the sixth word of this 5,000 word review to identify me as Jewish. In the review, he wrote the following. Beiner, like many Jewish commentators, seems to feel that Martin Heidegger owes him a personal apology for the Holocaust. For Johnson, Heidegger's ranting in the notorious Black Notebooks about a global Jewish conspiracy is not blameworthy, because Johnson himself shares the same views. Now, how could someone with extremist views like those held by Greg Johnson have anything to do with a humanizing discipline like philosophy? And yet, Johnson, in fact, holds a PhD in philosophy from Catholic University of America. Doctoral supervisor actually is an old friend of mine, it turned out. And having written a doctoral thesis on Immanuel Kant and Immanuel Swedenborg. And he's apparently taught philosophy in a number of colleges. Evidently, Kant's moral egalitarianism left little impression on him. In fact, it would be naive to think that intellectual life can be relied upon to generate only benevolent and humanistic worldviews. Immanuel Kant gave us the immortal line, out of the crooked timber of humanity, nothing can ever be made straight. And if the epigram is on target, then it will inevitably encompass what goes on in the precincts of academic and intellectual life. How do we teach the canonical texts that in significant measure define our mission as educators, knowing that they often contain the potential to produce monsters? Can one raise the largest questions in political theory and philosophy without opening a door to dangerous extremes? It has been known since Socrates, who practiced philosophy in the company of dubious figures like Critias and Alcibiades, that there is an uneasy relationship between the life of the mind and the potentially violent vortex of the political. Plato, too, played with fire by putting himself in the service of Sicilian tyrants. And he most likely wrote The Republic out of an awareness that potential tyrants are drawn to philosophy's root and branch questioning of established social conventions. To this very day, there are people who read ancient texts, not in spite of the fact that the ancient world embodied slavery, imperialism, and ruthless cruelty, but on account of a fetishizing fascination with those very things. One can't be true to the vocation of political theory without engaging, both intellectually and pedagogically, with the most radical minds. But one must do so always with the vivid awareness that many of the thinkers who loom large within our theory canon did contribute to, even if they weren't directly responsible for, terror and atrocity committed by those they influenced. Rousseau and Marx come immediately to mind. Of course, we could solve the problem by resolving only to teach peace-loving theorists such as Locke, Montesquieu, and John Stuart Mill. But it's telling that even Mill himself would be mightily unhappy with that solution. Now, teaching Nietzsche is particularly problematical. Undergraduates love him, and hence are all too vulnerable to his seductive rhetoric. In fact, Nietzsche, in The Gay Science, openly confesses his deliberate goal of titillating and enticing the young. He writes, "What thrills young men is the sight of the zeal surrounding a cause, and so to speak, the sight of the burning match, not the cause itself. The subtler seducers, therefore, know how to create in them the expectation of an explosion. Reasons are not the way to win over these powder kegs." He prided himself on being dynamite, capable of setting off unprecedented cataclysms. Consider Richard B. Spencer, America's most notorious white nationalist. Spencer attended three great universities: the University of Virginia, the University of Chicago, and Duke University. And by his own account, the decisive turning point on the path that led him to celebrity with his Hail Trump speech soon after Trump's election was a grad seminar on Nietzsche that he took at the second of these three universities. He famously described it in trademark alt-right vocabulary as his having been red-pilled by Nietzsche. Okay, when I teach a seminar on Nietzsche, as I've certainly done, is there any guarantee that a future Richard Spencer won't be in the room? We would be fooling ourselves if we didn't take with utter seriousness the Spencer trajectory, starting with Nietzsche seminars at grad school and ending with the torch-lit white nationalist rally in Charlottesville that Spencer helped organize. To be sure, not many people taking seminars on the thought of Nietzsche in grad school will turn into neo-fascists. It doesn't follow from that fact that there aren't things in Nietzsche's work capable of turning people into neo-fascists. This is in no way unique to Spencer. Fascists from Julius Evola to Alexander Dugin today and all of their followers have always been, not by accident, enthusiastic Nietzscheans. Martin Heidegger is no less worrying. Heidegger, no less than Nietzsche, and to a significant degree under Nietzsche's influence, regarded liberal democracy as a perverse and despiritualizing way of life. That's his conception. He publicly embraced the Nazi movement and believed that it offered tremendous promise for the West's return to spiritual health and grandeur. After the Second World War, he tried to persuade people that his commitment to Hitlerism had ceased in April 1934 when he resigned as rector of Freiburg University. Many people believed him, and some still do, but it wasn't true. In a telling exchange of letters with Herbert Marcuse, he said that he committed himself to fascism in the cause of spiritual renewal. And he clearly believed that spiritual renewal would indeed have been available if the party had allowed him, rather than ideological hacks, to guide the movement. In a book published in 1954, he fairly shockingly stated that the Second World War decided nothing, obviously because he couldn't bring himself to accept that democracy's defeat of fascist dictatorship was a definitive outcome. And Heidegger's consistent rhetoric of the need for an epic decision on the part of Europe, this rhetoric is drawn directly from the pages of Nietzsche. These are all well-known facts, but they've done nothing to diminish the spell that Heidegger has cast and continues to cast over countless readers throughout the liberal world, including legions of fans and defenders within the academy. Nietzsche was certainly compromised by European fascism. For instance, Hitler posed for a state photograph at the Nietzsche archives in Weimar and sent Mussolini the gift of Nietzsche's collected works. Well, with Heidegger, it's much worse. He shamed the proud tradition of philosophy by wearing a Nazi uniform and giving ardently pro-Hitler speeches. Nietzsche and Heidegger are towering thinkers, and we would be failing to educate our students about the summits of Western philosophy if we cut them out of the curriculum. Philosophy, from Plato to Spinoza to Rousseau to Marx, has always exposed the fundamental assumptions of established social and political life to radical questioning. And political theory would cease to be what it is and what it should be if radical thinkers of both the left and the right are deemed to be too dangerous to teach. We have to teach these books because our students would be left undereducated in the intellectual traditions of the West if we steered clear of some of the most important books of our philosophical tradition. But that does not mean that we should teach them without anxiety. Needless to say, there are complicated scholarly debates about the intellectual legacy of these two overwhelmingly influential philosophers. The culture and intellectual life of the last century would be vastly transformed if we attempted to subtract them from that cultural and intellectual history. In fact, their influence couldn't be effaced even if we tried. But that certainly doesn't mean that everyone who has read and been influenced by them is properly aware of the more dangerous aspects of their thought. When Richard Spencer reads Nietzsche, he sees things that are in fact there, but that less ideological readers filter out or assume that Nietzsche couldn't possibly have been serious about. Take slavery. In 1872, Nietzsche took it upon himself to declare the brutal truth that moderns have no wish to hear, that slavery belongs to the essence of real culture. Now, this assertion is no joke. Nietzsche is absolutely earnest about it. 15 years later, Nietzsche is still insisting on the same principle. As Bernhard Torek rightly points out, the endorsement of slavery is a crimson thread running through Nietzsche's political reflections from start to finish. Or take Nietzsche's celebrations of a caste morality. In the Antichrist, he refers to it as expressive of the natural order, a natural lawfulness of the first rank. And that's fully consistent with what he says on that topic in other texts. In Twilight of the Idols, he condemns Christianity as the decadent counter-movement to any morality, any sound morality of breeding, of race, of privilege. And in Beyond Good and Evil, he writes that democracy came about on account of the mixing of blood between masters and slaves. In the same vein, Nietzsche writes, this is Beyond Good and Evil, section 263, many natures have a baseness that suddenly bursts out like dirty water when any sort of holy vessel, any sort of treasure from a closed shrine is carried past. It is a great achievement when the masses have finally had the feeling bred into them that they cannot touch everything, that there are holy experiences which require them to take off their shoes and keep their dirty hands away. Last but not least, there's the intractable problem of Nietzsche's warrant for genocide. He writes at the Antichrist, section 2, the weak and the failures shall perish. The first principle of our love of man. And they shall even be given every possible assistance. Okay, the core idea is the following. If one wants to have pyramids that will be marveled at for millennia, one needs slaves to build these pyramids. You can choose to live in a society that doesn't aspire to build the kind of thing that will be marveled at for millennia. But then one will be chosen to live in a society ruled by those who should be in the slave class. That's a mistaken choice, he thinks. And modern societies that have opted to go that route will bore themselves to death and eventually collapse in on themselves. This is, at its core, the meaning of the doctrine of the last man. It was later restated quite explicitly in exactly these terms by the arch-fascist Julius Evola. Nietzsche was much less of an anti-Semite than Heidegger was, but that didn't stop him from writing in one of his last books that the Jews are the most catastrophic people of world history, and that one would no more choose to associate with the first Christians than with Polish Jews. They both do not smell good, he wrote. Are these lines that a supposed philo-Semite, many contemporary readers conceive Nietzsche, that a philo-Semite would write? For the record, I am a descendant of Jews from precisely the vicinity to which Nietzsche in this text is referring. And Jews, I think, could rightly say of Nietzsche, you know, with friends like this, who needs enemies?
On RN, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. This week, we're exploring philosophy and right-wing extremism with Ron Beiner, Professor of Political Philosophy at the University of Toronto and the author of Dangerous Minds, Nietzsche, Heidegger and the Return of the Far Right.
A couple of years ago, I taught an undergraduate course on politics and religion in the history of political thought. One of the texts I assigned was Nietzsche's Antichrist, a very rich text with lots of thought-provoking ideas, but also lots of truly ugly and offensive rhetoric. Sure enough, one of my students, having picked this text as the topic for his final essay, cited the book directly off a neo-Nazi website, www.nationalvanguard.org. Student obviously had no awareness where he was getting this or who was making the text available to him. Despite all the scholarly efforts to cleanse Nietzsche of all meaningful connections to fascism, it's no surprise at all that contemporary Nazis love this text. The great test of whether one can be genuinely honest about the character of Nietzsche's politics and the vision of life that animates those politics is whether one can read sections 37 to 39 of Skirmishes of an Untimely Man and Twilight of the Idols without flinching or without trying to pretend that he isn't writing what he is writing. Let me read a few juicy selections, though it's important to read the three sections in their entirety. Nietzsche begins by mocking a journal editor who is dumbfounded by Nietzsche's elevation of Cesare Borgia to the status of an Ubermensch. And Nietzsche's response to this, we should be under no illusion that Cesare Borgia's contemporaries would not laugh themselves to death at the comic spectacle of us moderns, with our thickly padded humanity going to any length to avoid bumping into a pebble. Nietzsche thinks it's a mistake to believe that one can have the transcendently superior culture of the Renaissance without the imperviousness to moral scruples of the Renaissance. And modernity is inherently incapable of the former because it is inherently incapable of appreciating how culture and immorality are an inseparable package. What modernity offers is a hyper-moralized environment where everyone is sick and everyone is a nurse, an old lady morality where the imperative to be kind and sensitive ruins anything that might make life worth living. What used to be the spice of life, Nietzsche says, would be poison for us. The liberal appeal to enhance freedom is for Nietzsche based on a false conception of freedom. Nothing damages freedom, he writes, more terribly or more thoroughly than liberal institutions. If liberalism offers a false understanding of freedom, where do we look for a correct understanding of it? Nietzsche tells us very clearly, war is what teaches people to be free. Becoming indifferent to hardship, cruelty, deprivation, even to life. Being ready to sacrifice people for your cause, yourself included. Freedom means that the manly instincts which take pleasure in war and victory have gained control over the other instincts, over the instinct of happiness, for instance. The appropriate test is the test of real freedom, as opposed to liberal freedom, is met by warriors who wipe their shoes on the miserable type of well-being that grocers, Christians, cows, females, Englishmen, and other Democrats dream about. All this is nicely encapsulated in a text in the Will to Power, section 864. The honorable term for mediocre is, of course, the word liberal. If Heidegger is right that Nietzsche's central teaching is that democracy equals nihilism, on what basis does Nietzsche believe that to be a valid conclusion? Democracy equals nihilism. That's Heidegger's encapsulation of Nietzsche, but I think it's accurate. Well, Genealogy of Morals, First Essay, Section 12, offers a very clear answer to that question. Nietzsche writes, we suspect that things will just continue to decline, getting thinner, better-natured, cleverer, more comfortable, more mediocre, more indifferent, more Chinese, more Christian. In losing our fear of man, we have also lost our love for him, our respect for him, our hope in him, and even our will to be man. What is nihilism today if it is not that? In an 1884 letter to his friend Malvida von Meisenbug, Nietzsche wrote the following. The sort of unqualified and utterly unsuitable people who may one day come to invoke my authority is a thought that fills me with dread. Yet that is the anguish of every great teacher of mankind. He knows that given the circumstances and the accidents, he can become a disaster as well as a blessing to mankind. And in my book, I endorse Stanley Rosen's judgment that Nietzsche, with his intended destruction of Western bourgeois society, guarantees the vulgarization that he feared. That is, himself prepares the way for his return to life in the guise of a self-constructed Frankenstein. And again, we're starting to see that once again here. We saw a fair bit of it in the 20th century. So in the political philosophical tradition within which Nietzsche and Heidegger both stand, the French Revolution inaugurates a moral universe where authority resides with the herd, not with the shepherd, with the mass, what Heidegger called the they, not with the elites. And as a consequence, ultimately, the whole experience of life spirals down into unbearable shallowness and meaninglessness. That's the core of their view. Now, all of this might have seemed irrelevant during the 70 years, roughly 1945 to 2015, when fascism was utterly discredited. It does not seem irrelevant today. On the contrary, liberal democracy seems to be increasingly on the defensive. Today, we have Trumpism and Bannonism in the US, Putinism in Russia, and Orbanism in Hungary, Erdoganism in Turkey, Shiism in China, Modiism in India, Duterteism in the Philippines, Bolsonaroism in Brazil. Admittedly, none of these leaders are as bad as Hitler or Mussolini or Stalin. But at the same time, none of them are reliable guardians of liberal democracy. Last spring, Roger Cohn published a New York Times op-ed on the rise of quasi-authoritarianism in Hungary and Poland, in which he quoted a former Polish foreign minister's expression of disdain toward those who believe history is headed inevitably toward a new mixture of cultures and races, a world made up of cyclists and vegetarians who only use renewable energy. The project of populist nationalism in Poland and Hungary is to defend what they take to be European Christian civilization from such pathetic wimps. This, one should not fail to recognize, is a 21st century version of Nietzsche's story about the last men. And the books being promoted by far-right outlets like Arctos, Radics and Countercurrents are a reflection of that. In fact, Arctos runs a video podcast called Interregnum, a familiar radical right trope. What it means is that we are currently inhabiting a liberal interregnum, guaranteed to come to an end with an eventual resumption of pre-1945 fascism. Liberal modernity is going down the drain or self-destructing, just as Nietzsche and Julius Evola said it would. This is the thought, and the fascist vanguard is preparing the cultural ground, what they call metapolitics, for the new dispensation to come. What I'm suggesting in this talk, and suggested in my book, is that we probably ought to be putting some effort into trying to grasp how some of our favorite authors are being read by people on the far right, since it should help us to come to a better understanding of more sinister aspects of their thought that get missed in or are brushed off by liberal and leftist appropriations of them. That maybe wasn't such an urgent task when fascism appeared to be safely deposited in the trash bin of history. It's looking more and more urgent today. What we call the liberal arts or liberal education are upheld by a kind of faith that engaging with ideas will indeed contribute to a more liberal, more generous-minded moral consciousness. Higher education in a liberal society involves teaching great representatives of the liberal tradition as well as great enemies of liberals. Is that the glory of liberal pedagogy, or is it its Achilles heel? The sober truth is commitment to a liberal education doesn't guarantee a commitment to liberalism. Thanks a lot.
And you've been listening to Ron Beiner, Professor of Political Science at the University of Toronto and the author of Dangerous Minds, Nietzsche, Heidegger and the Return of the Far Right. That was an edit of Ron Beiner's keynote address at the conference Philosophy and the Far Right, hosted by Deakin University in Melbourne late last year. You can listen again via the ABC Listen app or just head to the RN website and look for the Philosopher's Zone on the program menu, where you'll find streaming audio and download links. And of course, that whole process is made incredibly easy if you become a subscriber to the Philosopher's Zone podcast. And that's it for the program for this week. Next week, the problem of loneliness and isolation for elderly LGBT people and how existentialism can help. I hope you can join me then. I'm David Rutledge. Tweet me at David P. Zone, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.